As Al Gore learned the hard way in 2000 and Hillary Clinton in 2016, winning the most votes in a US presidential election is not enough to win the presidency. It depends very much where you win them. Of the four biggest prizes in the Electoral College in 2020, three look like locks for one party or the other. Barring a colossal upset, Texas will vote for Donald Trump. Barring outright sorcery, California and New York will break for Joe Biden. Not for the first time in recent history, Florida is poised to become a crucial battleground. Possibly, if the national contest is close, the crucial battleground. This is a grave responsibility for any state to bear, but it also makes for an unnerving spectacle for a watching nation, and indeed a watching world, given Florida's richly deserved reputation for eccentricity. Usually, when Florida makes the news, it's because yet another of its citizens has been arrested while brawling with an alligator in a Waffle House car park and dressed as Santa Claus in July, or similar. This fourth and final episode in our series on the 2020 US presidential election takes a close look at the Sunshine State. What is the deal with Florida? Who are its volatile electorate? How can Donald Trump and Joe Biden win them or lose them? And what does Florida think of what the world thinks of Florida? This is the Foreign Desk.
Latinos need something to vote for, and maybe they don't necessarily see that, you know, even though they might not support Donald Trump for president, they don't necessarily see Joe Biden as someone who is going to change a lot of the conditions that Latinos face in this country. Saying that you're not Donald Trump is not something that's going to convince a lot of minorities to vote for you.
We got 22 million people here now, plus we get 100 million tourists every year. It's that crush of humanity from so many different backgrounds and languages and cultures. And a friend of mine, a filmmaker named Billy Corbin, says we're not a melting pot. We're more like one of those TV dinners where the peas sometimes slosh over into the mashed potatoes.
There are so many different Floridas. There are so many cultures here. I mean, they're usually campaigning to these individual communities, and candidates are really trying to bisect the electorate, and in a way, that's sort of a microcosm of the country, and that, you know, it's not like three channels where there's one unifying national message anymore.
Hello and welcome to the Foreign Desk. I'm Andrew Muller. I'm joined today by Michael Grunwald and Bianca Padro Ocasio. Bianca is the general assignment reporter for El Nuevo Herald and the Miami Herald. Michael Grunwald is a senior writer at Politico magazine and the author of The Swamp, The Everglades, Florida, and the Politics of Paradise. In this first part of the show, I want to talk a bit about how we got here and why, at least since the famous near tie of 2000, it does just always seem to be Florida, or at least partially about Florida. And Michael, I'll ask you first, when and why did Florida become this key battleground?
You know, a Republican hasn't won the White House without Florida forever. So that's part of the reason that it's become so, you know, everybody desperately wants it. And it just seems to be this self-balancing state where it's about 20% immigrants. But, you know, the last 50 million votes that have been cast for presidential candidates in Florida, Republicans, Democrats are separated by about 20,000. We've had, you know, just about every election, every statewide election seems to come down to 1%. And just seems like every time another, you know, white person, Republican, moves down here from the Midwest, another Democratic-leaning immigrant may move into Central Florida from the Global South. And so it really seems to be self-balancing.
Bianca, are those demographics that monolithic? Is it a case of elderly white pensioners voting for Republicans and more recent arrivals from elsewhere trending Democrat? Or is there some kind of overlap between and spillage among those groups?
As you can probably imagine, it's a little bit more complex than that. I think that there's been kind of increasing awareness, you know, for both Democrats and Republicans that some of the key demographics here, you know, the Latin American immigrants, but, you know, you have the first generation, the second generation, you have the newer arrivals, you have, you know, the Venezuelans, you have the Cubans, you have the Puerto Ricans, you have the Haitians. There's such a mix of people and cultures and experiences. And when you add to that kind of, you know, the New Yorkers that are coming to Florida to, you know, retire, and you have all these different politics and ideologies kind of mixed together, I think you really get, you know, such a representation of both the conservatives and the liberals in both the U.S., but also in Latin America. And I think that when you look at South Florida, you see a lot of those dynamics kind of at play. You see, you know, from Colombia, you see the conservatives from Colombia, and you see the progressives from Colombia. So you have, you know, such a mix of just these ideologies, and that really kind of comes to shine, like Michael said, in the way that people vote.
Michael, is there a geographic split within Florida as well? Because it's the general tendency in the United States and elsewhere that cities tend to be more liberal, more vaguely left-wing. Rural parts of a given state or given country tend to be more conservative. Is it that clear-cut in that respect in Florida?
Well, again, I think Bianca is certainly right that it's always a little more complicated, but that's generally true. I mean, I think, you know, you saw in 2016 that Hillary Clinton did even better than expected in a lot of the urban areas. She beat Barack Obama, won Florida, and Hillary Clinton did even better in some of the, you know, particularly in South Florida, in Miami and Fort Lauderdale and West Palm Beach and some of the more urbanized area. But Donald Trump, there was an absolute revolution of essentially white people in the exurbs coming out and voting for Trump in the rural and sort of farther away from the cities. You don't want to over stereotype, but it's certainly true that the Republican coalition has, you know, the heart of it is older white people who are very reliable voters. And the Democratic coalition relies on younger, urban, lots of immigrants, lots of minorities who in the past have not been, their turnout has not been as high.
Bianca, those factors taken into consideration, that I guess the Republican parties and Democratic parties in Florida will have an amount, obviously, in common with the National Party and parties elsewhere. Is there still a distinctive political culture within Florida? Like, basically what I'm asking, are Florida Republicans different from other Republicans, and are Florida Democrats different from other states' Democrats?
I think that when it gets down to it, when you're thinking of, you know, are Florida Latinos, for example, are they always kind of leaning Democrat, or are, you know, Florida, South Florida Latinos, are they always leaning Republican, as people kind of think a lot of the time because of the Cuban American population? I think that a lot of that is changing. So, you know, whether or not you're going to see more Cuban Americans kind of still voting Republican in the way that they usually do, a lot of that is kind of breaking and being undone because of the younger generation, you know, really having more of an experience in the U.S. And seeing the way that, you know, their families grow up and thinking about healthcare and climate change as more of priorities to them. So, you know, I would say that the main difference, if there was one, is that here you can see a lot of the distinctive kind of, you know, you see mixed political ideologies in families. So, you know, I've met even candidates who are, you know, Democrats who are running now for public office in Florida, and their families, you know, are a different, completely different ideology from them. So I think that that's what's interesting, right? And what makes Florida, you know, such a unique and fascinating state is that it's changing all the time. And it's changing not just because of the new kind of waves of immigrants that are coming in, but also, you know, the new generations that are really having a different kind of awareness than the one their parents did.
We'll talk more in the second half of the program about how Florida may have changed in the last 4 years and what it might be like in this election. But Michael, just before we do that, I don't like to tempt fate too much by talking about what happened in 2000, when basically an entire parallel history of the 21st century got chalked off by a margin of a few hundred votes in Florida. Do people still talk about that election much in Florida, and what an immense sliding doors moment that was, not just for the United States, but as it turned out, for the entire world?
You know, I think that's a great way of putting it, because it certainly was. I mean, you know, you wouldn't have an Iraq war if it wasn't for 537 votes the other way. And I think it's just a great example of the way these elections in Florida are always won on the margins. It's sort of every community matters. Again, at the margins, these things make a huge difference. And I think, Republicans have been much better organized since 2000. And you saw it in 2000 with that Brooks Brothers riot. But everyone knows it's going to be close, and that it really is a place where every vote counts.
Michael Grunwald and Bianca Padro Ocasio, thank you both for the moment. We'll have more from you later in the show. Wondering what the deal is with Florida does not have to be a merely quadrennial preoccupation. Entering the phrase Florida man into a new search engine any day of the week will reap a bountiful harvest of inexplicable misbehaviour, so much so that Florida man has become one of the most cherished stereotypes of the social media age. Presidential election years, however, confront us with the sobering reality that Florida man doesn't only put on a bull costume and attempt to burn down a house with pasta sauce, call police after a strip club refuses to admit his cat, or show police a taco as ID, all genuine examples. He also votes. Here to introduce us properly to Florida Man is Craig Pittman, the author of Oh Florida, How America's Weirdest State Influences the Rest of the Country, and the forthcoming The State You're In, Florida Men, Florida Women, and Other Wildlife.
The man who wanted to run from Florida to Bermuda in a bubble on the ocean has been reined in by the Coast Guard. This is the second rescue mission of the Bubble Man since 2012, and the Coast Guard is none too happy about it.
I think it began around the presidential recount in 2000, so about 20 years ago. That seems to be the point at which most of America and indeed the world started regarding Florida not as a wonderful vacation playland, but as a place full of really odd people doing very odd things. And we've certainly done nothing to dispel that notion since then. There was a story just yesterday where someone went to a veterinary clinic and stole 4 vials of cat blood.
They say at first he just walked up and checked out the Anastasia Cat Clinic in St. Augustine, September 17th. Then around 20 minutes later, he returned and took a box containing 4 vials of cat blood.
Don't know why. Don't know what they could do with it. There was some speculation he was trying to create a new superhero Catman, but it's like, why would you do that? Why would anyone do that?
Welcome to all of the magic and all of the wonder of Walt Disney World Resort. And just imagine, you're going to be right here in the middle of everything.
I think Florida's generally recognized as, vacation land, sun and fun land. And so I grew up going to the beach and enjoying it and thinking I'm very lucky that I get to do this. But I didn't realize that we were weird at that point. This was in the 1960s. Everybody thought California was the weird state. But in the meantime, as I'm growing up, my parents are reading stories to each other from the paper. Hey, honey, guess what? And then it would be something wacky and wild. Like there's a story that Dave Barry often tells about during the 1980s, some smugglers were trying to bring in cocaine with a plane, and the Coast Guard got wind of it, and they were chasing them in an own plane. And so the smugglers decided to lighten their load so they could go faster. So they threw the cocaine out of the plane, and it was in a bale, and the bale tumbled end over end and happened to land right in the middle of a crime watch meeting in Homestead and just barely missed hitting the police chief in the head. I mean, that's something that would not happen in any other state, only in Florida. But it didn't get widespread notoriety at the time because, there wasn't an internet.
The opioid crisis hits just about every economic level of society, but rarely will you see it as raw and open as you do on the streets of one South Florida neighborhood, where children are forced to walk around needles as they make their way to school.
I think the thing that happens is that people get caught up in the humor of it and may not realize that if you look a little bit below the surface, a lot of these are very sad stories. People who are addicted to drugs, people who are homeless, people who are in the grip of some sort of psychological problem. I wrote a book called Oh Florida, How America's Weirdest State Influences the Rest of the Country. And in it, I sort of went down the list of these are the things that produce all these stories. You know, we've got such a temperate climate. People are out doing weird things all year long. We have more nudist resorts than anywhere else. More machetes are sold in Florida than anywhere else. But a major factor is that we consistently rank 49th in the list of states for spending on mental health, to which I can only say thank God for Texas. A big factor, in addition to the mental health spending, is we've undergone a wrenching demographic change unlike any other state has experienced. In 1940, at the start of World War II, we were the least populated southern state. And World War II brought a lot of soldiers here to train for the war, and they sort of fell in love with the place and started moving here, helped along by the GI Bill. And so now we are the third most populous state. We passed New York in 2014. And people aren't spread evenly over the whole peninsula. They're sort of clumped in a 30-mile wide swath along the coast and along Interstate 4 where the theme parks are. So you cram that many people together in that small a space in that short a length of time, and they're bound to start ramming into each other's cars and chasing each other around with machetes. I mean, we got 22 million people here now, plus we get 100 million tourists every year who come down here, and inevitably some of them wind up doing weird things as well. So it's that crush of humanity from so many different backgrounds and languages and cultures. And a friend of mine, a filmmaker named Billy Corbin, says we're not a melting pot. We're more like one of those TV dinners where the peas sometimes slosh over into the mashed potatoes. I think we tend to be more laid back, more casual than people in other states. I mean, there's a common joke among Floridians about, you know, did you wear your good flip-flops or your everyday flip-flops? And I think also, this is going to sound strange in this day and age, but we tend to be more accepting of people who are from elsewhere. Just because two-thirds of us are from elsewhere, we actually have more people in Florida who are from somewhere else than any other state except Nevada. About a third of us are natives, and we often joke that we're endangered species. But you know that those folks coming in are the ones who are sort of the bolstering our economy. So there's a tendency to think, okay, you know, let's try and accommodate these people and explain things to them. In fact, I've actually started a podcast called Welcome to Florida to try and explain things to all the new people moving in, to say, okay, here's some survival tips for Florida. Here's some things you should know. And, you know, so we've interviewed an alligator wrangler and a python hunter and people like that, you know, just your everyday Floridians, just to get them knowledgeable about that. And we're going to have someone come on and talk about Florida politics and how Florida politics, because of our mix of people, is so split down the middle. We really are a microcosm of America, because every one of our big elections ends up in a recount because the margin is so razor thin. I mean, it happened for governor, for senator, and for president the last several times. So it's just sort of a sign of how we reflect America back to itself in a sort of a funhouse mirror.
That was Craig Pittman, author of Oh Florida, among other titles. You're listening to The Foreign Desk. Still with me are Michael Grunwald and Bianca Padro Ocasio. In this back half of the program, I want to focus specifically on what's going to happen in Florida over the next few weeks before Election Day. Obviously, as we've established, Florida is a great prize. It may even be the decisive one. Both candidates are absolutely desperate to win it. Bianca, I'll ask you, when you're running for president and hoping to win Florida, are there specifically Florida issues that you find yourself campaigning on, or specifically Florida things even that you need to do? Is there an equivalent of going to Pennsylvania and pretending you enjoy cheesesteak sandwiches?
That's a great question. I think that healthcare is a big issue that matters to a lot of voters in Florida. You know, specifically in South Florida, there's some jurisdictions in the Miami-Dade area that have some of the highest rates of Medicaid in the country. And I think that this is important because it matters even more at the local level and kind of the congressional level. But I would say that when it comes to kind of some of the talking points that campaigns are bringing here, we see Republicans kind of talk a lot about socialism, right? And that casting Democrats as the ones that are trying to bring socialism and the socialism that you escaped from in your home country to the United States. And, you know, for some people, that's not really an effective talking point because they think that Biden cannot compare to some of the, you know, Nicolás Maduros or Fidel Castros of the world. But I think that for a lot of other people, it is something that matters to them. And it is important that they hear the presidential candidates say that this is not something that they support, that they don't support socialist policies, because they bring with them a lot of this trauma that is passed on, as we have seen with the Cuban American population through generations.
But just to follow that up, Bianca, does that explain then, first of all, why we have seen President Donald Trump claiming to have been the recipient of something he called the Bay of Pigs Award, which turned out actually not to exist, but he claimed this was given to him by grateful Cuban Americans? And does it perhaps also explain why, according to recent polling at least, Joe Biden is doing really notably badly with a lot of Latino communities in Florida?
There's a couple of reasons why Joe Biden is not necessarily doing as well as some people have expected with Latinos, but a lot of it, and there's been kind of some stories about kind of this gender divide in the Latin American communities and Latino communities. But, you know, I think it all comes down to the fact that Latinos need something to vote for, and maybe they don't necessarily see that, you know, even though they don't, they might not support Donald Trump for president, they don't necessarily see Joe Biden as someone who is going to change a lot of the conditions that Latin Americans and Latinos face in this country. And that goes as well for the Haitian American community in Florida. You know, saying that you're not Donald Trump is not something that's going to convince a lot of minorities to vote for you. There was a story that the Miami Herald did of when Kamala Harris came to South Florida and did a visit with a lot of different Venezuelan groups and other ethnicities, and Haitian Americans felt that they were cast out and that they were not included in these meetings. So, you know, you have to really think of how a lot of these communities that have felt neglected by Democrats and Republicans through the years, how are they going to feel that Joe Biden is going to fix that? And that's what it really comes down to.
Michael, if not being Donald Trump is not necessarily an advantage in Florida, is being Donald Trump actually an advantage in Florida? By which I guess I'm asking, does he have a measure of home field advantage here? He obviously has run the world for some stretch of his presidency from his resort at Mar-a-Lago. Do Floridians, or do any Floridians, sort of look at Donald Trump and think he's one of us?
You mean as a Floridian? You know, probably not. But there isn't really, you know, Floridians don't really have, you know, there's so many different Floridas. And I think what Bianca was getting at is that there are so many cultures here, right? And that's your question about how people campaign. I mean, they're usually campaigning to these individual communities. They come and talk to the Jews about Israel. They come and talk to the Cubans. You know, they go to Versailles in Miami, which is the big Cuban restaurant, and they talk about Castro and communism. They go to the Everglades and they talk about the environment, because there are a lot of environmentalists here even. And, you know, and they go to elderly communities and they talk about Social Security and Medicare. Joe Biden's approach has been really focusing more on trying to grow his vote to try to take away some of Donald Trump's older vote, which is so far, if you look at the polls, he's been quite successful in that. He has not been as diligent about reaching out to minority communities and trying to increase turnout out there. And that could reflect why, you know, particularly in the Latin vote, he doesn't seem to be doing as well as a Democrat might want to. And in Florida, he may be hoping that in the end, you know, a lot of Puerto Ricans where he's really not doing as well as you expect, they might just remember that Trump went down to Puerto Rico and threw paper towels at people and joked about how corrupt the place was and how it didn't deserve aid after a horrific hurricane. Florida is not, there's not one Florida. There are 22 million people here, and candidates are really trying to bisect the electorate and campaign. And in a way, that's sort of a microcosm of the country, and that, you know, it's not like three channels where there's one unifying national message anymore.
I mean, Bianca, all of that being the case, so far, at least into this campaign, what have you actually seen or heard of the two candidates for president? Obviously, this campaign is weird for all sorts of reasons. They can't travel as much as they might prefer to. But if you're watching television in Florida, or if you're reading newspapers in Florida, what are you seeing and hearing from Biden and Trump? Basically, what's their pitch to Florida?
Yeah, I mean, I think that Michael's absolutely right. They have different pitches to different communities. I think that one example that has been more visible to me just because I'm interested in the community. So what we call the I-4 corridor is that central area in the state of Florida, which includes Orlando, Tampa, even all the way to Daytona Beach. And it has had a very growing population of Puerto Ricans, many of them who came to the state after Hurricane Maria in 2017. And I think that this is very interesting because it also has been, you know, the surrounding parts of Orlando are also very historically kind of Republican areas, right? So, you know, we have seen Pence earlier on this year kind of making a pitch to evangelicals talking about abortion and, you know, kind of using this as an issue of something that, you know, Trump stands for. And then, you know, we have, now that it's closer to the election, Joe Biden has gone to Kissimmee, which is south of Orlando, to talk to the Puerto Rican community and say, this is my plan for the island, and this is what I want to do that is different from Donald Trump. But I think that for a lot of Puerto Ricans in particular, this has been a little bit too late in the process to be really pitching to them that he's going to be different from Donald Trump, and he's going to kind of make amends to some of the negligence from the federal government after Hurricane Maria. So I think that, you know, now there's a little bit more focus on faith leaders. We've seen Catholics for Trump in Miami. We've seen Catholics for Biden in Miami as well. So, you know, I do think that there's kind of this attempt to grow these coalitions and to really, you know, see how many votes can you carve out of each community. So we'll just see who does it better, I guess, in November.
I mean, Michael, there's always a lot of talk about Florida and the other big states about the demographic shifts that might be going on within them and what that might mean for the future. I know certain parts of the Democratic Party are quite excited about Texas maybe 4 or 8 years from now. When you look at Florida, do you imagine one day it ever tipping firmly red or blue, or is Florida, do you think, just going to remain eternally and infuriatingly purple?
Well, I guess it would sort of depend on demographic trends, but also on turnout trends, right? Right now, like you have this sort of self-balancing situation where 10 of the 25 fastest growing metropolitan areas in the United States are in Florida, and 9 of them voted for Trump. Those are basically white retirees. And at the same time, you have this, you know, the state is getting browner every year. Every year, it's a couple percent more Latin immigration. And the question is just, you know, are they going to vote, and are they going to vote in the numbers that Democrats hope? You mentioned the ads on television. Most of Biden's ads right now are just about healthcare. He tells his personal story about losing his family, losing his first wife, and then how he lost his son to cancer. And he talks about how lucky he was to have healthcare. He ties his personal story to a policy issue. I mean, I've seen some Spanish language ads, and I don't know if they were from his campaign or just from supporters, but they were basically reaching out to Latinos and telling them that don't vote for Biden. He cares more about blacks. You know, I think you can see in that where the two different parties think the state is going. But I don't think anybody knows.
We are unfortunately coming to the end of the show. And Bianca, I'll ask you finally, the reason we're doing the show is, of course, because there does seem to have been this recurring pattern that the entire world gets completely fascinated by Florida for a few weeks towards the end of a US presidential election campaign. Does that register within Florida at all? Do you have a sense as a state that the world is kind of watching, and watching indeed through balled up fists at this point, wondering which way on earth Florida will jump this time?
Yeah, I mean, I would be curious to hear what Michael has to say as a more longtime Florida resident, but I think so. I think that there's kind of a pride in that, and I think that there's a consciousness of, you know, that your vote actually counts here. And, you know, it's not just at the presidential level. I mean, you look at the state level races, and some of them are won by, you know, a couple hundred votes. And it's just such an exciting, you know, keep you on your toes kind of state.
And Michael, because Bianca offered to throw it to you as well, I will throw it to you as well. Do you think that you and your fellow Floridians have an apt enough sense that you hold the world's destiny in your hands?
Well, I think perhaps an overdeveloped sense, if you know, leave it to me to be the negative one. But, you know, we expect to be sucked up to, right? I mean, this is a state with no income tax. It's a state where a lot of people, they're from Cincinnati. They come down here, they live, they don't want to pay taxes, they don't care about the schools, you know, they don't care about public services. And then when they die, they're going to be buried back in Cincinnati. And you can see from our environmental history, this is we're a state of takers, and we expect candidates to come and give, and they do. You see, like Donald Trump is promising, he's like in the pocket of big oil, but here he is coming to Florida and promising, oh no, no offshore drilling off Florida. Florida's different from everything else I've said about energy. So I think we've come to expect that, and it's a little bit pathetic, but you know, with these elections so close and a lot of electoral votes, you understand why they do it.
Michael Grunewald and Bianca Padro Ocasio, thank you both very much for joining us here on the Foreign Desk. That's it for this episode of The Foreign Desk. We'll be back next week, and look out for The Foreign Desk Explainer, available every Wednesday. The Foreign Desk was produced and edited by Yolin Goffan and Christy Evans. Christy also produces The Foreign Desk Explainer. From me, Andrew Muller, thanks very much for listening. Until next time, goodbye.